Cassette 3, Side 1. Chapter 9. The combination of Harvard and Haiti had begun to form a new kind of belief in Farmer. He would tell me years later, "The fact that any sort of religious faith was so disdained at Harvard and so important to the poor, not just in Haiti but elsewhere too, made me even more convinced that faith must be something good. And if the landless peasants of Cange needed to believe that someone omniscient was keeping score, by now Farmer felt the need to believe something like that himself. In the peasant phrase, an unnecessary death was a stupid death, and he was seeing a lot of those. Surely someone is witnessing this horror show, he'd say to himself. I know it sounds shallow, the opiate thing, needing to believe, palliating pain, but it didn't feel shallow. It was more profound than other sentiments I'd known, and I was taken with the idea that in an ostensibly godless world that worshipped money and power, or, more seductively, a sense of personal efficacy and advancement, like at Duke and Harvard, there was still a place to look for God, and that was in the suffering of the poor. You want to talk crucifixion? I'll show you crucifixion, you bastards." When Ophelia went back to the Central Plateau to work with Paul in the summer of 1985, she saw that, when he dressed up now in Haiti, he often wore a large wooden cross hanging outside his shirt. But the apparatus only reinforced a quality of priestliness that she'd sensed in him before, and that quality was far from thorough. He would say, some years later, that he had faith, then add, "I also have faith in penicillin, rifampin, isoniazid, and the good absorption of the fluoroquinolones, in bench science, clinical trials, scientific progress, that HIV is the cause of every case of AIDS, that the rich oppress the poor, that wealth is flowing in the wrong direction, that this will cause more epidemics and kill millions. I have faith that those things are true too. So if I had to choose between Lib Theo or any ology, I would go with science as long as service to the poor went along with it. But I don't have to make that choice, do I?" He'd never cared much about the religious dogma he'd been taught as a child, and he didn't believe in most of it now. He would say, for instance, "I'm still looking for something in the sacred text that says, 'Thou shalt not use condoms.'" He was still the very young man who would challenge Ophelia to mango-eating contests that turned into slimy food fights, and he was quite willing to ignore the injunctions about chastity that the bishop had uttered at his confirmation in Florida years ago. Indeed, he was happy to skip church services in order to violate those injunctions. Ophelia remembered the afternoon when she gave herself to him. She chuckled at the term. It was a Sunday. They were in Mirebalais and got caught in a rainstorm and ran back to Père Lafontaine's rectory. The building was empty because everyone else was in church, and in Haiti church services tend to last a long time. Moreover, most Haitians don't like being out in the rain. "You knew that until it ended, no one would be coming," she said. "We took a shower together." She remembered the sound of the rain on the roof, the smell of the smoke from the fire out in the courtyard lit for Sunday dinner. The moment, she said, still stood in her memory as the most romantic of her life. She spent the whole summer in Haiti with Paul. In the evenings, over coffee, she'd help him with his formal medical education. She'd try to help, that is. He had distilled the contents of his medical texts onto index cards. He had great piles of them, thousands of flashcards. On one side, he'd have written, in an elegant, left-handed script, a question such as, "What's gout got to do with lysosomes?" And he'd have added the symbols for musical notes around the words, indicating that the question should be sung. The question side of a card might read, for example, "Show me, sir, the lesions in Homer's syndrome and oculomotor nerve paralysis, and what the divil's an Argyle Robertson pupil." The answers on the back often included drawings, many of them lovely, Ophelia thought. In that case, a drawing of the neural pathways of the eye. Ophelia looked through the stack of index cards for a question that Paul might answer wrong, hoping he would. It felt good to be able to read him the correct answer, as if she was actually helping. "Okay, PJ, what's dystrophic calcification?" "When abnormal deposition of calcium salts takes place in necrotic tissues, It's known as dystrophic calcification. He'd lift a finger in the air. Of course, it's not caused by hypercalcemia. He'd smile. Metastatic calcification is associated with hypercalcemia, however. She'd stare at the back of the index card, trying not to look let down. Right. Very good, PJ. They walked to villages from time to time. On the way, he'd point out plants. Indigo, he'd say, and then, with an eager smile, what's the Latin name? He'd been doing this since she'd first met him. At moments, she wondered if he was trying to make her feel uneducated. No, you twit, of course not, she thought. He just likes to say the names. It's one of his ideas of fun. But it was hard to avoid comparing herself with him. At almost every hut they visited, food would appear, a great deal of it unsavory to both of them, items from what Paul called the fifth food group. And, making faces at each other when their hosts weren't looking, they pretended to munch happily on things like meat-filled pastries that smelled like sweat. Then one time their hosts presented each of them with what looked like a fried egg afloat in pig fat and gristle, and she took a bite and almost gagged on it. When the hosts turned away for a moment, she handed her plate to Paul, whispering, "Here, you eat it." He took the plate and slurped the contents down. Then he looked at her and smiled. "B-minus," he said. On the way back, they laughed about the incident. And yet of all the times she'd eaten things that she could hardly bear to look at, this one occasion when she failed the test stood out for her. Coming down a steep trail in one of the hills around Cange, she lost her footing momentarily. There were Haitians nearby. "Watch your step!" someone called to her in Creole. She felt the muscles in her jaw flex. Did they think she was a weakling? An elderly man came up to her and offered his walking stick. "No, I'm fine," she said. Paul's face looked stern. "Don't refuse something like that," he said to her emphatically. "It's an incredible gift." Of course, he was right. Her cheeks burned. They slept in different quarters in Cange. The patriarch of the place was, after all, a priest. One night, about to turn in, she decided that tomorrow she'd get up earlier than Paul. She set her alarm clock for 5. She woke to the sound of his voice singing up to her from the courtyard below her window, and she lay in bed thinking, "I just want to do something better than him, for a moment." Paul had expanded and refined the health census he'd begun around Cange in 1983. He'd found a book that described a census done in a rural part of India, and he used it as a manual. Ophelia worked on gathering data. This meant walking from village to village, sometimes with Paul, more often with local youths he had recruited, who knew the ways, down gullies and up mountainsides, along paths half covered in underbrush. The heat felt enormous. Her face would turn bright red, but her Creole greatly improved, and every trip seemed important and wrenching. She'd go to a tiny two-room hut, a chair would appear, and the peasants would offer her a drink and talk about their pain and misery while she took notes. She would ask them when they were born, and they would tell her what president had been in power at the time, or date their births to before or after the dam. Ophelia would ask, "How many live here?" And the mother or father of the house would reel off names, sometimes as many as 11, and Ophelia would look up and see slivers of sky through the banana bark roof and think about the rainy season. She'd see the metal cups on the stilts of their small granaries and think, rats. She noted a distinctive smell inside the crowded huts. Not smelly socks, stinky, but the close smell of people in poverty, many hungry people breathing. Sometimes she went to houses where people were dying, and often, especially in Cange, among the water refugees. These were children in the throes of one or another of the diarrheal diseases. To get water, the people of Cange had to climb down a steep 800-foot hillside. They'd dip their calabash gourds or recycled plastic jugs in the stagnant reservoir, then carry them back up the hill, and of course they'd want to make that water last. So it would sit in the jugs or gourds, uncovered for days. The solution came from a team of Haitian and American engineers. The Americans were members of the church group from the Episcopal Diocese of Upper South Carolina who had been helping out Père Lafontaine for years. A sparkling underground river burst out near the base of the 800-foot hill. Before the dam, it had been a main source of local drinking water. The engineers devised a plan to use the force of that river to carry its own water in a pipe up to communal water spigots that would be constructed in Cange. Almost as soon as this was accomplished, Ophelia remembered, infant deaths began dropping. Farmer was learning about the great importance of water to public health, and he was conceiving a great fondness for technology in general. Also scorn for the Luddite trap. He liked to illustrate the meaning of that phrase with the story of the time when he came back to Cange from Harvard and found that Père Lafontaine had overseen the construction of 30 fine-looking concrete latrines scattered through the village. But, Farmer asked, are they appropriate technology? He'd picked up the term in a class at the Harvard School of Public Health. As a rule, it meant that one should use only the simplest technologies required to do a job.
Do you know what appropriate technology means? It means good things for rich people and shit for the poor, the priest growled, and refused to speak to Farmer again for a couple of days.
Lafontaine was also supervising the construction of a clinic in Cange. The South Carolinians had put up the money. The facility would have a laboratory, of course. Farmer got hold of a pamphlet about how to equip labs in third world places published by the World Health Organization. It made modest recommendations. You could make do with only one sink. If it wasn't easy to arrange for electricity, you could rely on solar power. A homemade solar-powered microscope would serve for most purposes. He threw the booklet away. The first microscope in Cange was a real one, which he stole from Harvard Medical School.
Redistributive justice, he'd later say. We were just helping them not go to hell.
The enterprise in Cange and the surrounding villages was essentially the creation, from scratch, of a public health system, with Père Lafontaine as the construction boss. Amazing how quickly and durably he got things built in a place without electricity, stores, or a serviceable road. Increasingly, the vision for this health system came from Farmer. A lot of the plan was straightforward, steps that any school of public health would recommend. He'd begun with the census because that was the way to identify problems and to begin building records, and to create a baseline against which future censuses could measure how well the new system was working. He planned for the creation of what he called a first line of defenses out in the communities. These would include vaccination programs, protected water supplies, and sanitation, and at the heart of the defenses, a cadre of people from the villages trained to administer medicines and give classes on health, to treat minor ailments and recognize the symptoms of grave ones like TB, malaria, typhoid. He imagined his project for women, gynecological services, health education, and family planning, to reduce local maternal mortality. What the first line of defenses failed to prevent would be handled at the second line, at the new Clinique Bon Sauveur in Cange, which Farmer imagined would someday have a hospital beside it. To many people in public health, such an array of projects would have seemed ambitious enough, indeed too much to hope for in a place as impoverished as Cange. But by 1985, Farmer had grown impatient with standard definitions of public health. The great burdens of disease in Cange were just a symptom of a general deprivation, he'd say to Ophelia. He'd tell her, "We have to think about health in the broadest possible sense." This notion came in part from Lafontaine. He had built the first school in Cange back in the late 1970s. It had a thatched roof. Classes that didn't fit inside were held under a mango tree. In the early 1980s, with money from South Carolina, Lafontaine had erected a much larger building, 2 stories tall, on a small plateau on the hillside above Highway 3. To Farmer, the building looked faintly grandiose, looming above the shacks of Cange. He would write, "The establishment of a school may seem a bit out of place given the homelessness, landlessness, and hunger of many of the water refugees, but it appears that they themselves did not feel that way. Children flocked to the new facility. One peasant woman explained, "A lot of us wondered what would have happened if we had known how to write. If we had known how to write,
perhaps we wouldn't be in this situation now. And a school could serve as a place for teaching lessons about health and for providing free meals to malnourished children without injuring their dignity. To build a school was to unite the practical and the moral. Farmer would say, "Clean water and health care, and school and food and tin roofs and cement floors, all of these things should constitute a set of basics that people must have as birthrights." All this would require money beyond what the South Carolinians could provide. Farmer had only limited experience as a fundraiser. In 1985, though, he got lucky. 2 years before, late in 1983, he'd gone to Boston for his standard pre-admissions interview at Harvard and had visited a charity named Project Bread. He'd asked the organization for a few thousand dollars to build a bread oven in Cange. He'd often heard Père Lafontaine say that Cange needed a bakery. It had been an easy sell. Farmer was told that the charity had a donor who had asked that his money go to feed poor people in Haiti. "Who is he?" Farmer asked. "He's an anonymous donor." The bread oven was built, not far from the school, in the summer of 1984. Early the following year, a Harvard Medical School publication printed Farmer's essay, "The Anthropologist Within." Soon afterward, the director of Project Bread contacted Farmer. The bread oven's anonymous donor had read the article. "I'd like to meet this kid," the donor had supposedly said. "He sounds like a winner." "If he wants to meet me, tell him to come to Haiti," Farmer replied. He had been told that the donor's name was Tom White, and that the man owned a heavy construction firm in Boston. Farmer imagined portly Republicans smoking stogies and cutting back-alley deals with the Massachusetts Bay Transit Authority, keeping the unions out. Farmer went to pick up White at the François Duvalier Airport. The person he found waiting there in the hot wind was a pink-faced man in his 60s, dressed in polyester golfing clothes, including the plaid pants. White had brought along a roll of cash, which he had soon distributed among beggars. Not an obnoxious act in Farmer's philosophy, but hardly a sufficient one. Farmer narrated Haiti in the truck on the way to Cange, and White seemed appropriately horrified. But Farmer was still wary of him, and didn't try to hide the fact. He was only 25, and not, he would admit, fully formed when it came to dealing with potential donors. Inside the jouncing truck, the conversation turned to American politics. White remarked, "Well, I didn't vote for Reagan." "What do you mean?" said Farmer. "I didn't vote for Reagan." "So you voted against your own interests?" asked Farmer. "Is that a sin?" said White. Remembering that moment, White told me, "So he went from being cool to very warm." White went on, "He was fresh as hell to me, but I liked him, because if you said boo and he didn't think boo was right, he'd tell you. He was way ahead of me on service to the poor." The next time Farmer returned to Cambridge, Tom White took him to lunch, and they had an argument about guilt. White said he thought it was a useless emotion. "On the contrary," Farmer said, "it could be quite helpful." White had gotten divorced from his first wife. He had made a very generous voluntary settlement with her and footed all the bills for his children's keep and education. His second marriage, to a woman with 6 children of her own, was hardly the conventional rich man's. Nonetheless, he said, he felt very guilty about the fact of his divorce. This wasn't what Farmer had in mind. What he endorsed, he said, was the guilt some rich people felt toward the poor, because it could cause them to part with some of their money, and they ought to feel guilty besides. Actually, White had been giving away money for years to Catholic charities and needy friends, even before he'd had much of his own. He grew up in an Irish Catholic household devastated by his father's drinking, and at an early age became what he called the go-to guy in his family. He'd had a colorful-sounding life, college at Harvard, where he majored in Romance languages, and then the Army, where he became, reluctantly at first, the aide to General Maxwell Taylor, commander of the 101st Airborne Division. White parachuted into Normandy the night before D-Day, and later into Holland. Though he would say he didn't regret participating, he came away with a hatred for war, and though he liked Taylor personally and admired the general's courage, he learned to dislike the tendency of the powerful to view human beings as pins on a map. Also to dislike the perquisites of power, through seeing a young paratrooper crushed by his own pack, overweight with unnecessary items he carried for the general. After the war, White had built his father's construction company into what was now the largest in Boston. He had been the intimate of cardinals, had served on the boards of 9 institutions, and had sat with the presidential party at JFK's inauguration. But he felt uncomfortable among most of the rich and famous, and generally shunned the press. He told me, cryptically, that he had been depressed at various times in his life. Also, that he'd had a low self-image, adding, "But in my business, all you had to be was low bidder." When I asked him what had caused him to place large bets on Farmer, on a medical student in his 20s, White said, "He appealed to me immediately. So intelligent, so dedicated to his work." He thought for a time. "I really can't explain it. I probably was also looking for somebody to hang my hat with." Certainly Haiti upset White. He found the road to Cange especially offensive. "Jogging along that damn road," he'd say. He never traveled it without thinking, "This would be so damn easy to fix." He remembered his first view of Kwashiorkor. "There was a kid with red hair and a bloated belly, and I said right away, 'Put in a feeding program here.'" White found it easy to imagine himself a Haitian, a child with big eyes and a memorable smile, encountered in a dirt-floored hut, made him feel like bringing over the company bulldozers. "For Christ's sake," he'd say to Farmer or Père LaFontaine, "put a tin roof on and pour a concrete floor. I'll give you the money. Holy shit." When Farmer was back in Boston doing his internship at the Brigham, White would drive over at lunchtime and buy sandwiches at the restaurant inside the hospital. He and Farmer would eat them in White's car. One day White asked Farmer, who looked pale, as usual, "You eaten enough?" "Oh, I'm fine," said Farmer. "Need any money?" "No," said Farmer. "Well, maybe $40? White happened to have a wad of $100 bills in his pocket. He tossed one into Farmer's lap. "You look hungry to me." Saying this, he felt impelled to reach in his pocket again. He tossed another $100 to Farmer. "Please, for God's sakes, eat," he said. And to emphasize the point, he gave Farmer yet another $100. Farmer looked down at the loot. "Now I can tell you what happened last night." He'd gone to the home of an AIDS patient whom he had treated at the Brigham and found out the man was about to be evicted. "I signed my check over to him."
"Geez, Paul, don't you think that's kind of impractical?"
Farmer smiled. "Well," he said, "God sent you today." White often found himself running errands in Boston for projects in Cange, picking up things like sinks and loading them into the trunk of his Mercedes. One load of sinks was for a new clinic. The first clinic turned out to have been badly designed. White paid to have it rebuilt. He did this quietly, not asking for credit. "Not even a plaque with his name on it," said Farmer. One time when they were together in Boston, White said, "You know, Paul, sometimes I'd like to chuck it all and work as a missionary with you in Haiti." Farmer thought for a while, then said, "In your particular case, that would be a sin."
Chapter 10. In a photograph that Ophelia took in the mid-1980s, Paul appears in shorts, 5 or 10 pounds heavier than in the coming decades, thin but not remarkably so. He crouches, his hands still smoothing the dirt around a seedling he's just planted, on the once barren hillside above Highway 3, where each time she returned, Ophelia found another young grove of trees, another new building or two. She came back every summer, from 1985 until 1989. They were months of nearly constant work. By early afternoon, Paul would still be seeing patients, and famished herself, she'd go to his office in the clinic. "You're not hungry? All you had was coffee at 6 this morning." He'd agree to come up the hill to the kitchen with her, but usually reluctantly, she felt. From time to time, she longed to get away from that desolate region. She'd talk Paul into trips to Port-au-Prince, always feeling sort of scummy for taking him away. She would tell him, "This is about getting things for the clinic." Before they left, she'd grab a handful of his index cards. The drive was a little less than 3 hours back then. When, as often happened, they punctured a tire or broke a spring and had to wait for repairs, they would sit by the road and she would quiz him. And they would, in fact, buy medicines and equipment and more flora for Paul to plant around the growing medical complex on the hillside in Cange. At the end of one of those weekends, they were driving down Delmas Street on their way out of Port-au-Prince, and Ophelia was thinking of the long, hot walks ahead of her in Cange, and of how wonderful it was to return from them and drink a Diet Coke. "I'd love to get some Diet Coke," she said. Paul said, "We don't have time. We can't do it." She understood that he wanted to get back to Cange, and that making the stop would mean not just a 20-minute delay, but also walking past the beggars into a supermarket that served the Haitian elite. But at the moment, his words nettled her. He seemed to be saying that if he and the peasantry could get along without things like Diet Coke, so could she. He was so sure about some things, she remembered. The frustrating thing was, he usually was right. In the car, she started in on him, accusing him of self-righteousness. She didn't let up. Finally, he slammed on the brakes, reached across her, and pushed open her door. "Get out!" he yelled, and called her a foul name. She didn't obey. She sat rigidly in her seat, feeling both offended and also exultant, smiling inwardly, thinking, "Yes, I got to you. You have this human quality. You're flawed." Another trip to Port-au-Prince stood out in her memory. It was in 1986, not long after Baby Doc left Haiti, an event that marked the end of the Duvalier's reign, which was being followed by what dissident Haitians called Duvalierism without Duvalier, with the Haitian army generally taking on the dictatorial role. All that summer, there had been signs of unrest, still rather disorganized, impromptu roadblocks made of burning tires, peasants demonstrating in Mirebalais. A lot of peasants, it seemed, had imagined their lives would improve when Baby Doc left. Now they were protesting the continuation of the status quo. There was, for Ophelia, a feeling in the air that things could erupt at any moment. She and Paul went to Port-au-Prince for the weekend and were staying at the house that the Lafontaines kept in the city. They'd driven downtown on an errand. When they came outside, it seemed to Ophelia that the street had become unusually still, and amid the normal sour odor of the capital, she smelled burning tires. The smell of something being burned that shouldn't be. But kids had taken the keys from their car. While Paul was negotiating with them to get the keys back, Ophelia stared down the street, at its intersection with a larger avenue. Suddenly she saw what in Haiti is known as a courrie, literally a run, a stampede of people passing the intersection, and then large Haitian army trucks with mounted guns in close pursuit. She heard shots. The aftermath of a political demonstration, clearly. In a moment, demonstrators came running down the street, surrounding their car and all the others that were trying to back and fill and get away from there. She and Paul opened the doors to let in some of the wounded. Meanwhile, she began having stomach cramps. "PJ, let's get out of here." Eventually, they got free, and Paul drove to the Lafontaine's house. She got out, but he stayed behind the wheel. "I have to go back, Min." "PJ, please don't." But he went, right back into the thick of the trouble, demonstrators climbing over the car while soldiers clubbed them. He took several more bloodied civilians in and came back unbloodied himself. "It was very important to Paul to witness things," Ophelia would say, looking back. She went on, "That smell of burning tires never quite leaves you. The smell is forever associated for me with political violence." There wasn't much of that out in Cange, but even there the change in atmosphere was obvious. In previous years, before Baby Doc's forced departure, the peasants had rarely dared to talk politics. Now, as a saying went, Babouquette la tombée, the muzzle had fallen off. Farmer would later write, "Not only were the villagers talking about subjects previously forbidden, they were talking about old subjects in new ways. They were no longer merely asking if infant diarrhea was caused by germs, but asking whether the germs were caused by dirty water. And didn't dirty water come from the neglect of feckless, greedy governments? For many years to come, the smell of burning tires, the smell of revolt, of roadblocks and massacres, would be an abiding odor in Haiti, and in Ophelia's life, and Paul's. In 1988, Ophelia came to Boston to live with Paul. By now, he had entered the phase of medical school known as clinical rotations, stretches of training at Boston hospitals, usually lasting a month apiece. Paul rarely missed a day of those, but even when he was in Boston, Haiti was never far from his thoughts. He had said to Ophelia when she'd begun working with him in Cannes, "We need to bring resources down here. Will you help me?" Back in England, after the summer of 1985, she had done some modest fundraising of her own and, on Paul's instructions, bought 10 scales for weighing babies to use for identifying infants at risk in the continuing health census. She brought the scales and the remaining cash to Cannes the following summer. By then they'd begun to talk about creating an organization that would support the growing health system around Cannes. Tom White agreed to pitch in, and in 1987 he made the idea real. He hired a lawyer to draw up the papers, creating a public charity in Boston called Partners in Health and a corresponding sister organization in Haiti, Zami La Santé. Partners in Health would solicit and receive contributions, make them tax-free, and funnel the money, mostly Tom White's, to Cange. White put up $1 million as what he called seed money. Farmer also turned to another well-heeled friend, his old classmate at Duke, Todd McCormick, who was now living in Boston. McCormick was amused at the notion that he, at 28 and working in his father's business, should be on the board of advisors of anything, but he knew Farmer was in earnest, and he readily agreed. It seemed to McCormick that, for Paul, PIH wasn't just a stratagem, but also a way of trying to create a new communion. It was a way he could institutionalize what he felt so passionately about, a vehicle through which his friends could participate, McCormick would tell me. Paul's Catholic Church. Some months after the official founding of Partners in Health, Farmer expanded the group, adding a fellow Harvard anthropology and medical student, a Korean-American named Jim Yong Kim. Jim joined PIH after a series of conversations with Paul in Boston, not unlike the long, windy chats Ophelia had with Paul in Port-au-Prince. Farmer offered what for Jim Kim was a convincing vision of the new organization. The reality was less impressive. A charity with a board of advisors and no hired staff except for a bibulous would-be poet housed in a one-room office above a seafood restaurant in Cambridge. Paul, Ophelia, Jim, and Tom White were most of what there was to PIH, and they spent a great deal of time together. Sometimes the three young people would stay at one of Tom's houses. Tom would go to bed long before they did, and in the mornings growl at them, "I don't know what you guys talk about all night long." They talked about issues such as political correctness, which Jim Kim defined as follows. "It's a very well-crafted tool to distract us, a very self-centered activity. Clean up your own vocabulary so you can show everybody you have the social capital of having been in circles where these things are talked about on a regular basis." What was an example of political correctness? Some academic types would say to Jim and Paul, "Why do you call your patients poor people? They don't call themselves poor people." Jim would reply, "Okay, how about soon dead people?" They talked about the insignificance of cultural barriers when it came to the Haitian peasants' acceptance of modern Western medicine. There's nothing like a cure for a disease to change people's cultural values. They talked about appearance, the goofiness of radicals thinking they have to dress in Guatemalan peasant clothes. The poor don't want you to look like them. They want you to dress in a suit and go get them food and water. Comma. Some people said that medicine addresses only the symptoms of poverty. This, they agreed, was true, and they'd make common cause with anyone sincerely trying to change the political economies of countries like Haiti. But it didn't follow, as some self-styled radicals said, that good works without revolution only prolonged the status quo, that the only thing projects like Cange really accomplish is the creation of dependency. The poor were suffering. They were dying like smelt. Partners in Health believed in sending resources from the United States to Cange, down the steep gradient of inequality, so as to provide services to the desperately poor, directly, now. They called this pragmatic solidarity. A goofy term, perhaps, but the great thing about it was that, if you really practiced it, you didn't have to define it. You could simply point at what had been accomplished. Paul and Jim and Ophelia would go out to dinner
and they'd still be talking about these matters when the restaurant shut down. Then they'd go to Jim's apartment and talk some more. They spent a lot of time defining themselves, rather often by defining what they weren't. WLs were forever saying, "Things aren't that black and white." But some things were plenty black and white, they told each other. Areas of moral clarity, which they called AMCs. These were situations, rare in the world, where what ought to be done seemed perfectly clear. But the doing was always complicated, always difficult. They often talked about those difficulties. How Paul and Jim should balance work for PIH with going to school and getting their degrees. What PIH ought to do next in its adopted piece of Haiti, where AMCs abounded. Among many other things, they decided to build another school in a desolate village near Cange. It was called Caille Epin, House of Pines, and it lacked almost everything, including much in the way of trees. Ophelia's father put up the money, 3,000 English pounds. On an evening in 1988, Farmer was hurrying around Cambridge doing last-minute errands before flying to Haiti, where construction of the school was about to begin. He stepped off a curb and got hit by a car. It shattered his knee. So instead of going to Haiti, he went to the Massachusetts General Hospital. He languished there for weeks, then returned in a gigantic cast to the apartment he shared with Ophelia. She tried to nurse him. Setting up routine housekeeping with Paul hadn't led to a dwindling of affection. "I knew that he loved me, and I loved him," she would say. But for her, relations were strained. "The strain of living with a fellow who was in love with something else, something that I could never compete with, even if I'd wanted to." Often, if he could get away from medical school or his anthropology seminars early on Friday, he'd catch a flight to Haiti for a few days, sometimes just for the weekend. "Please don't go," she said to him on one of those occasions. "Stay with me." "Come with me," he replied. They argued. He told her, "I was clear about what I wanted to do with my life, and I thought you wanted to join me." Alone in the apartment afterward, she thought, "It's true. He never said we'd go for walks in the woods, visit art museums, go to the opera." Everything got more difficult after the accident. Paul was restive in his clumsy cast and angry because he yearned to get back to his clinic in Cange. She'd remind him he was supposed to keep weight off his broken leg, but he wouldn't listen. She'd cook for him, but he wouldn't eat. She did her best, but she didn't suffer silently. They had some rows. Finally, he said to her, "I'm going to Haiti. They don't mind looking after me there." Years later, she'd still remember the date, December 10th, 1988. They would patch up their quarrel, but inwardly, she knew something had ended. When he proposed to her a couple of years later, she found it hard to say no, but impossible to say yes. Hurt and angry, he told her, "If I can't be your husband, I can't be your friend. It would be too painful." For a time after that, she got her only news of him through Jim Kim. Away from Paul, her interest in becoming a doctor waned. She really didn't like chemistry, but she hated the separation from Paul. More than ever, he seemed to her like an important person to believe in. Not as a figure to watch from a distance thinking, "Oh, look, there is good in the world." Not as a comforting example, but the opposite. As proof that it was possible to put up a fight. As a goad to make others realize that if people could be kept from dying unnecessarily, then one had to act. She intended to remain part of PIH and of Paul's life. She knew he had a great weakness for forgiving people. It was, she thought, the most salient of his priestly qualities. "Gradually, I filtered back," she said. Partners in Health was still being invented, the sort of organization where members could make up their own job descriptions. Once she had filtered back, Ophelia took on PIH's finances and began scheming about creating an endowment. She insisted on being paid a salary of about $15,000, and yearly contributed three times as much. As for relations with Paul, within a few years, they seemed nearly perfect to her. Sometimes when he called her, fresh off the plane from Haiti, after a week or a month away,
She'd picture herself his wife, uttering bitter recriminations. But there was none of that now. She simply felt happy at the prospect of seeing him again, and she could tell he felt the same when he appeared in the doorway. "Min!" he'd cry, and reach out his arms to her, wearing a wild-looking grin, his face turning bright red. Only his sisters could make him laugh the way she did. It made her feel essential to him when she'd crack a bawdy joke about some mutual acquaintance and see him fall back onto a sofa, scissoring his feet in the air, laughing so hard that his asthma kicked up. He seemed to feel that he could tell her anything now that he had no formal obligations to her. She'd say to herself sometimes, "Being his wife would have been no bargain, but to be his friend is simply wonderful." Chapter 11. In December 1988, Farmer returned to Cange in a wheelchair, and while his leg mended, he launched his study to improve TB treatment in the Central Plateau. Big events were happening in Cange, momentous events, in Haiti. He witnessed some of those, once his leg had healed, on trips to Port-au-Prince. Several times, he was in churches in the capital when shooting started, and he took refuge behind pillars. Since the departure of Baby Doc Duvalier, various unelected governments had succeeded one another, but it was really the Haitian army that ruled the country from 1986 to 1990, with aid from the United States, as Farmer would discover, searching official published documents. He was a student of Haitian history, and he knew that trading one corrupt, repressive, and unelected government for another was nothing new for the country or for American policy toward Haiti. Nor were uprisings among the impoverished majority. But it looked to him as though a great popular movement might really be in progress now. With what seemed like unusual unanimity, the peasants and the people in the slums had embraced something called déchoucage, the uprooting of every visible symbol of the Duvaliers, which included the public persecution and sometimes the killing of former Tonton Macoute, mostly small fry, of course. The reaction of the Haitian army and its paramilitaries was extreme. There was violence on all sides, but as usual, the side with guns and money was responsible for most of it. Farmer witnessed some of the incidents and heard about others. Later, he dug up verification. Haitian army soldiers shooting unarmed demonstrators, entering urban hospitals and threatening staff, sometimes executing patients, even stealing corpses now and then. In 1987, the army's paramilitaries had massacred scores of voters at polling places, aborting what would have been the first democratic elections in Haiti's history. According to one old saying, perhaps less true by then than formerly, Haiti was 90% Catholic and 100% voodoo. Speaking of a devoutly Christian peasant, Farmer once said to me, "Of course he believes in voodoo. He just believes it's wrong." Catholic churches were at the center of the popular revolt. Not the cathedrals, where the Duvalierist hierarchy presided, but what was called Tileglise, the small churches of the ruined countryside and of the city's slums. The most important of these was St. Jean Bosco in Port-au-Prince, where the priest Jean-Bertrand Aristide presided. Farmer had first heard him speak in 1986 over the radio in Cange. He'd decided to go to Aristide's church and hear him in person. The crowd was rapt, and so was Farmer. Aristide said, as Farmer remembered his words, "People read the gospel as if it pertained to another place and time, but the struggles described there are in the here and now. The oppression of the poor, the abuse of the vulnerable, and the redemption that comes with fighting for what is right. What ideas could be more relevant in our dear Haiti?" Farmer remembered, "I'd been looking all over for the Progressive Liberation Theology Church in Haiti, and here it was." He joined the crowd that went up to meet Aristide after the Mass. Aristide could hardly have failed to notice him. Not many of his parishioners were white, tall, and creolophone. They had become friends, but Farmer didn't see much of Aristide in 1988. He was very busy himself in Cange, and Aristide was busy surviving a series of attempted assassinations, including the firebombing of his church, which the mayor of Port-au-Prince arranged. Farmer was hoping for real change in Haiti, and meanwhile hating what he called the tumble,
the turmoil and bloodshed and their inevitable byproduct, the worsening of Haiti's already wretched public health. On a day in 1989, he climbed alone to the top of a hill overlooking Cange. In Haiti, he didn't usually write anything except official correspondence and thank you notes. He didn't usually have time, and besides, writing seemed much less important here than doctoring and building schools and water systems. But he was making an exception on this day, and he climbed the hill to do some work on his PhD thesis in anthropology. AIDS and Accusation, he'd call it, the first of his alliterative titles. AIDS had come to Cange about 2 years after he had, back in 1985. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please reverse or turn the cassette over now.